are committed elsewhere. So can we welcome Mr. Bassett and Mrs.
Stein.
Mrs. Stein, yeah, you are most welcome. And then you are here to update us on Court of Law Amendment Bill and the Constitutional Court judgment. The time, unfortunately, I don't know. What time is it, Mr. Horn? Honorable Horn?
Now, just past 12 o'clock.
Yeah, past 12. Maybe we can afford you, because we are supposed to be there by 2 o'clock, and members have to go and prepare themselves for, you know, to have lunch and take their jackets. Like Mr. Horn, you can see, Honorable Horn doesn't have a jacket with him. So, over to you, Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There were two documents that were circulated. Just let me explain what they are. And I realize the time constraints, and we need guidance from the committee on how to deal with it. There are two documents that were circulated, and the one is entitled Short Summary of Submissions to Portfolio Committee on the Courts of Law Amendment Bill and the responses of the department to the submissions that were made. I want to make the point, Chair, that there were two rounds, as it were, of submission of comments. We just to remind honourable members, there were public hearings. The department summarised the comments that were received and gave responses to the committee. And then the committee invited stakeholders to come with a second round of submissions. And some stakeholders made use of that opportunity, and they submitted a second round of comments. ADRA comes to mind, I think the LSSA, and maybe one or two others, I can't remember. So this document that's been circulated is 41 pages. It's a summary of all the submissions that were made to date and our responses to those submissions. Some of the, we haven't dealt with, the department hasn't given responses to some of the, this document. So the department hasn't given responses to the second round of submissions that were made. So this document gives responses, summarizes every one of the submissions that were made and gives responses to them all. And then the second document is what I'd like to call a working document. It's the bill that was introduced into Parliament with proposed changes. Those proposed changes to the bill are as a result of our responses to the submissions that were made, to the queries that were raised by the Portfolio Committee on the previous occasion. There were a number of those as well. And also some of the changes to the bill that's in the working document are as a result of the Constitutional Court judgment in the Stellenbosch matters. What we've also done, we were asked to analyze the Constitutional Court judgment, which we think we have done, and we would like to present that to the committee during the course of the report back. But before we made the proposals or the proposed amendments to the bill, we also had discussions with our colleagues in the DTI and the National Treasury, because as the committee will remember, we worked very closely with those two departments who have a particular interest in the bill when we were preparing it in the first place. So the proposals that are on the table now, Chair, are really proposals that are being submitted by the department for this committee's consideration. We also tried to, in the time that was available, to get some input from magistrates, and we will deal with that as we go through it. What I would suggest, Madam Chair, for your consideration is that maybe a good place to start with our deliberations, because I see we have also a meeting set for Friday, and I think there will be some further deliberations on this bill if I have a look at the committee's program. And there is quite a bit to say if we're going to take the committee through the response document. Maybe the best place to start when we last met was coincidentally the day that the Constitutional Court brought out the judgment in the Stellenbosch matter. So it might be a good idea, if the committee agrees, that we just talk briefly about the Constitutional Court judgment and then start start with the comments that were received, what our department's response is, and the and deal with the proposed amendments that would give effect to the proposals that were made. But we're in your hands, Chair. Ask Mr. Steyn to do it. We have the Stellenbosch judgment is set out in the in this document that I've been speaking about. If I think if you go to page 33. And I'll just do the introduction. It's a summary of the Constitutional Court judgment, and it sets out the background, what the case was about. I think we all know what it's about, so I don't think it's necessary to deal with that. And there were three judgments, in effect. And I'm going to ask Ms. Steyn, really, just to, I'm not going to go into the three judgments, separate judgments, but to talk about what the effect of the, or to talk about what the Constitutional Court actually said in a sort of summary sense. So I won't even go through all those pages 34 and 35 and 36 and 37 that deals with the with all the three different judgments, some of which have the same effect. Then maybe Ms. Steyn can deal with the effect, and that's the important part, the effect of the order of the Constitutional Court in the Stellenbosch matter on the Courts of Law Amendment Bill as it was introduced into Parliament and the changes that need to be brought about as a result of that judgment. And we would like to put those proposals or those ideas on the table for the committee's consideration. If I may hand over to Mrs. Steyn, thank you.
May I proceed? The effect of the order on the bill before the committee is that the provisions which the bill seek to do away with, that is regarding the consent of a debtor to an EIO or the issuing of an EIO in the instance where an installment order has already been made and the judgment creditor or his attorney has complied with certain requirements. In the bill, we are deleting those provisions. The Constitutional Court did not confirm the deletion of these provisions as the Western Cape High Court did, but those provisions remain. What the Constitutional Court did is to read in some provisions, to which I will come now. Basically that the issuing of an EIO must have been authorized by the court and that the court must be satisfied that the order to issue a emoluments attachment order is just and equitable and that the amount is appropriate. The effect in essence is then that the issuing of an EIO must be authorized by the court whether the debtor consents to an EIO or not, or whether there is compliance with certain requirements where an installment order has already been made or not. So there are two options available which could be explored. The first is that seeing that the effect in essence is that an EIO must be authorized by the court, the first option is to keep the provisions of the bill intact. The deletion, in other words, the deletion of the provisions as to the consent or to the existing installment order, and to add the words, after satisfying itself that it is just and equitable, that an emoluments attachment order be issued and that the amount is appropriate, in the provisions of the bill which deal with the authorization of an EIO. We propose in the bill as introduced that in sections 57 and 58 provision be made that the court can authorize the issue of an emoluments attachment order. So all those provisions need to be revisited for us to then include the order of the Constitutional Court regarding just and equitable orders. And then the second option would be is to retain the provisions of the Magistrates Court Act as it reads currently, and then add thereto the orders given by the Constitutional Court. The Department is of the view that the first option is more appropriate because the bill should still ensure that any possible abuse of emoluments attachment orders, for instance, the consent to an EAO, should be minimized. And as Mr. Bassett has pointed out, that the Department met with the DTI as well as the National Treasury, and they both agree with this approach.
I think if I may come in here. May I come in here? I think the two important features of the Constitutional Court judgment is that there must be judicial oversight, and that there must be when these are authorized, and the test that they used or it used for seeing whether an EAO should be authorized or not, is it just and equitable, and is it an appropriate amount? Our bill used a test of sufficient means, so that is a departure from what our bill had. It's a just and equitable and an appropriate amount as against sufficient means, and then it's judicial oversight. So those are two key features that came out of the out of the judgment, and those two features still feature in our bill. I think, Chair, that is a sort of a summary. You said 8 minutes. I hope we've beaten your 8 minutes of what it's about. I don't know whether the committee members want more information. We've got a full document which sets out, a much longer document, which sets out the Constitutional Court judgment. But in this document, at the end of the document, as I say, there is Annexure A, so there is information about the Constitutional Court judgment, and it sets out what Mrs. Stain has said.
Okay, thank you. I remember last time when we were here, the same day, the court was asking for it. Remember then we said, yes, we will do this very well. And then, honorable members, any comments?
I see Honorable
Ons. Yeah, Chair, this is just a question. The way I read the feel about the judgment, I just want to hear from the department whether the, because I have not, you said it was circulated, but this is the first time we see it, whether the idea is still there that before the issuing of an emolument attachment order, there must be a physical appearance before a magistrate or a judicial officer for an type of investigation to come to the conclusion that the issuing will be just and equitable. Because, I mean, judicial oversight does not necessarily mean or have to call for physical appearance. So I just want to get the way the department is thinking about this at this stage and how this is addressed.
Just one question also, Chair. There was, in this case, there was the issue of the clerk of the court. So I wanted to check at the at the final judgment, what was supposed to be the role of the clerk of the court vis-a-vis the court itself? Thanks.
Okay. Over to you, Mrs. Payne.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chairperson. In terms of Section 57 and 58, The idea will be that the court should have sufficient documentary evidence before it, and based on that to see whether it will be just and equitable to make an EAO order or authorize the emoluments attachment order. In terms of the other sections, it's, in terms of Section 65, I-1 where the debtor is summoned to appear, obviously then the debtor will be in court, and then the other option would be that there's an application in for an emoluments attached will have to be served on the debtor, and obviously you will have to appear. I'm not sure if that answers your question. With regard to the question of the clerk of the court and the role of the court, the court, or if I can say then, the magistrate must authorize an emoluments attachment order after satisfying itself that it's just and equitable to do so and that the amount is appropriate. But the physical issuing of the document will be done by the clerk of the court. The clerk of the court must ensure that there is an authorization for an emoluments attachment order, and then if all the particulars on the form are correct, then the clerk of the court can issue the order, but it's authorized by the court.
In the past, just to add to that, Madam Chair, is that the clerks did that in the past with no judicial oversight. And that's what the Constitutional Court said was wrong, and that's what the bill oversight, yes.
Yeah, you see, I might be having some shortcomings because I'm also just seeing this judgment now, but I wanted to check from the department. In your opinion, because this was a case involving some low-paid members of a particular, did they win this case? Or, okay.
Maybe what you want to know, because you know, the legal, the risk is the severance of. So when you interpret this,
To lay people or to ordinary people, to these low wage earners, what do we say according to what Honorable Maila is saying? And as to this court case, I remember immediately it was delivered, a day or two thereafter, the Secretariat or Research Unit sent it to us. Maybe we didn't see it because it was sooner with Concord letterhead, I remember. Yes, thank you so much. Honorable Horn?
Yeah, now just to clarify, what I'm saying is the department mentioned that these documents with us today was supplied to Parliament beforehand, but we did not receive this beforehand, not the judgment.
If I may just say, they were only submitted to Parliament yesterday, so maybe that's why they never received.
Sorry. Madam Acting Chair, in follow-up, can we maybe just ask the issue of the 25%, how this is now going to be dealt with going forward? Is this still part of the bill?
Yes, it is still part of the bill. You might recall that at the previous meeting, there was, I think it was you that raised the concern as how to creditors must share in this 25%, and we prepared a provision in Section 65J to try to deal with that. It is now a proposed subclause 1A, paragraph A provides that the emoluments attachment order, the amount may not exceed the 25%, that is as it was before, and then we have provided to say that what the basic salary means. And then in C, when a court considers the authorization of an EAO or any other order contemplated in Section 65, 65J, and after having considered all submissions before the court and considered all further available documents, if the court is satisfied that there are other emoluments attachment orders, the court must postpone the further consideration of the authorization and set the matter down for hearing, and then the party applying for the authorization of the EAO must serve notice of the date of hearing on the other creditors or their attorneys and the judgment debtor, if he or she was not present or represented when the case was postponed. And then in three, the court may, after hearing all parties at the ensuing hearing, make an order regarding the division of the amount available, and then again referring to the just and equitable order, and that the sum must be appropriate, and then also as to the division of the amount, and ensure that 25% is not exceeded. So that is a proposal that we are tabling.
We would have taken committee through that, through those proposals as we go through the bill, as we would suggest that it be amended subject to the committee's consideration thereof. But just to add to and what Mrs. Steyn said about, you know, the question arose in this committee, what happens, when you reach the 25%, the cap, is there sharing? And what Mrs. Steyn's just explained is, yes, there is a sharing, and we've tried to put a mechanism in place to deal with the sharing. So basically, if you have one person that has one EAO against his or her name, and then a new creditor comes in and wants to get an EAO authorized against the same debtor, then and 25% of the debtor's salary is already being used up, there's got to be a rearrangement, and the court comes into the play there and gets all the creditors together and considers everything and does a sort of a rearrangement of the payments for the two EAOs now in the place of one, so that there's an equal sharing. I think that's what everybody seems to want, and that's what National Treasury wants, that's what the DTI wants. If we're going to have that, it seems that's the way to go. But it was only raised yesterday, and in fairness, I haven't got an answer to that yet. As yet, I discussed it with Ms. Steyn, and we would like to go back. We also took this to some magistrates to deal with civil matters to say what they feel about it, and they were very comfortable and said it's nice because there's now certainty. They have more certainty in applying the law if we have a mechanism like this with a 25%. Be that as it may, the uncertainty that has crept in, if we do have a mechanism like that, although we're proposing it, but we only realized yesterday that this could be something that we need to give further consideration. Is it right, scenario that I've just sketched, you've got a debtor who's been paying one creditor over 2 years, 25% of his or her salary, and now a new creditor comes in, and then the first creditor has got to play second fiddle or half. The first creditor was there and has organized his operations and business on the basis of getting that money every month. Now all of a sudden it's halved. Is it fair to the first creditor to have that happen? It's just something that I think the committee needs to consider. On the other hand, so that's a concern that's come up and that we would like to try and think about a little bit more and perhaps help advise the committee on that, because we came up with a proposal, but it does seem to have perhaps unintended consequences. But on the other hand, an argument, and I think we need to put the counter argument on the table as well. The second creditor, it could be argued, shouldn't have given the debtor credit in the first place, knowing that he already has an EAO against his name, and it amounted to reckless lending. So there are those two scenarios that we would like to sketch and just to place on the table.
The scenarios, yes, may you dwell on those? Because you made mention of something which is very serious. which you seek the committee's indulgence. May you, the issue raised by Honorable One, please, in 2 minutes. The first and second scenario that is bad for the first creditor because of water. That's it.
Thanks, Chair. Yes. The situation could arise like that. You've got one creditor and one debtor, and there's an EAO against the debtor to pay creditor number one. 2 years later, for instance, a second creditor comes and wants to get an EAO, but the debtor is paying 25% of his salary. Yeah, to creditor number one. Now, what we propose in the bill is the magistrate, before giving an EAO to creditor number two, must look at creditor number one and creditor number two and see how the 25% can be split between the two creditors so that there's an equal sharing of the 25%. So that's what I think we had in mind, and maybe it's still the way to go, because there seemed to be a need to share the 25%, and it's not a case of one person or one creditor getting everything, getting all to the detriment of the other.
The 25% ceiling has been reached through first creditor. Then there is second, there is third, and so forth. In terms of benchmarking, what happens normally in other jurisdictions?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, there are some progressive scales I think I'm not quite sure whether it's in Germany or the USA. For example, there's a 12% of your salary for the lower wage level, and then it goes up to, I think, something like 35%. And in some jurisdictions, there are also a minimum wage that is protected. So that is far as I know that is done in some other jurisdictions.
Yeah, Chair, the issue firstly of the second creditor, and when that whether that could have been a reckless credit lending, I think is something the department should look at. But one must also remember that sometimes you fall in hard financial ways, not necessarily through credit you took up, but just through circumstances. Let's say you get into a car crash and you have medical bills or whatever. So I agree it's a tricky issue we should be looking at going forward. But I just also still want to put on the table regarding the 25%, and Mrs. Steiner just now made mention of a minimum wage that's protected in some jurisdictions. Is we must also bear in mind, and I think that still needs to be addressed, that 25% of salaries is not equal for everybody. And it may be unfair also to credit providers in certain circumstances to cap this at 25%. If I, for example, and funnily enough, there is people like that, earn 50,000 rand a month, but I still fall into a debt cycle, then the issue is really, if only 25% of my salary is attachable on a monthly basis, I still can lead a fairly comfortable life, in any event, much more comfortable than somebody who earns 10,000 rand a month and 25% is attachable. For example, in terms of our insolvency legislation, it's up to the curator or the liquidator to decide what is a livable income for somebody who's declared insolvent, and he can then attach, if you are a salary earner, everything above the livable income for you and your dependents. And I'm just asking whether, and I know it might be difficult, but I'm still having this discomfort on just setting it at 25%, if it may lead to a situation where it's actually not that bad for some people to have huge debts.
You know, these things of percentages sometimes are a problem. But, you see, if maybe for argument's sake, somebody is earning 10,000, another is earning 50,000, even their 25% will not be the same. One will be, maybe 25% will be about 2,500, meaning that he has about 7,500 to play around with, which will not be bad for that person's particular level of standard of living. So my take was, we are doing this in order to protect who? The, what do you call them, who's owing the credit, the debtors. We are trying to protect the debtors, because the creditors also have a responsibility to check the level of debt of the people that they give credit to. Because if you talk now about the second creditor, the third creditor, which is what was happening, that the clerk of the court will give an order for order number one, number two, number three, until at the end the person is almost earning nothing because of the garnishing orders. So I don't know, Chairperson, in the interest of time, where are we in terms of what we are supposed to do?
If you ask what still needs to be sort of reported back here, where did we leave off, I think, and that we won't be able to do today, because there's just too much, because all the changes to the bill are new. So this is the first time we're coming back to this committee with all the proposed changes as a result, as I said, of the Constitutional Court, as a result of questions that were raised by this Portfolio Committee the last time, and as a result of submissions that were made by the various stakeholders. So there's a lot to discuss, and it'll be difficult to, I don't think we will be in a position to tell the committee what is left to report back to answer your question. I see, and I think maybe that was the purpose, that there's a meeting scheduled for Friday, and then I think sometime again next week. I'm not too sure if it's next week or the weekend. Or
Were you denied the right to make decisions?
No, I think I'm taking into consideration this issue raised by a member. We may not form a problem about what we say, but another challenge is that maybe they have already paid for everything up to Friday. But in the meantime, maybe what we can do is the secretariat liaise with the church. I think tomorrow we are also meeting at 8:30. Then we take it from there. What to do?
Madam Chair, the difficulty I think from the department side may be that if they are not needed on Friday, they can return to Gauteng today. Otherwise, I don't know whether they would have, I don't want to say hung around, but hung around for tomorrow and met us again on Friday. So I think that will still not solve their problem.
I think the reason why we have the meeting tomorrow was because there were issues with Friday, if I remember well. Because the first proposal was that we should meet on Friday, but we ended up agreeing on meeting tomorrow.
Then on the program, we still have court law amendment day. This was scheduled, the only program, the only agenda item for Friday. Okay, I'm a bit uncertain. But I don't have that.
Can we maybe, if I may assist, Madam Acting Chair, can we maybe ask the Secretary to try and sort this out with the Chair urgently and let the Department know and us as well?
This is none of my business, but also if it can help, we could possibly be at the meeting tomorrow, although we're not involved tomorrow, so that it can be decided on at the meeting tomorrow. About the way forward, when we're going to meet again. I don't. But we wouldn't have come to the meeting tomorrow, but we can come to the meeting tomorrow if it would assist in any way.
Because tomorrow's meeting was specifically scheduled for Human Rights Commission.
But Chair, what I'm trying to say is we could also just hang around here for the full committee to make a decision whether the meeting's going ahead on Friday. Yes.
I wanted to check the deadlines that the department is supposed to beat. How do they stand on this particular legislation?
That's Parliament's prerogative. So I think Parliament must...
Okay. Thank you so much. Let's see what has been resolved upon. Thank you very much.
I have failed. Not in this vacation form. Also have to lie.
Thank you.